Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Pianci, and I'm joined, as usual, by my partner in crime, Mr. Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
Well, I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm doing fine, except for a little construction work still going on here. But we are joined by a fantastic guest today, someone we've been trying to have on the show for a long time now. Mr. Evan Ratliff, how are you?
I'm doing well. I got a leaf blower out here, so I'm bringing some sound problems to the party, too.
We're all professional podcasters, just to be clear. All three of us on this call know what we're doing.
That's very convincing when you're shouting it at the top of your lungs. Anyway, Evan has done a ton of work that Bennett and I are both have been fascinated by for a very long time. He is doing a podcast right now called Persona. It's fantastic. We urge everybody to check that out. It's about Gilbert Chicly. We'll get into that a little bit later. He also wrote a wonderful book called The Mastermind about Paul LaRue. And I think that's what we're actually going to start with right now. Can you start us off just maybe explain what The Mastermind is about and who Paul LaRue is?
Yeah, so the book is about a large organized crime cartel that is was run by this guy named Paul Calder LaRue. And so in some ways, it's like a biography of LaRue. And in some ways, it's about the way this type of organization operates. And the basics of it are that Paul LaRue is a programmer who built this network of online prescription pill sites in the early 2000s. And what they sold predominantly, vastly more than any other prescription pill, were painkillers. And they sold millions upon millions upon millions of painkillers entirely to the American market. It was kind of a genius system, the way he set it up to sell these pills to American customers. And then he made a tremendous amount of money doing that, hundreds of millions of dollars. And he set up shop in the Philippines. And then he sort of set about taking that basic prescription pill empire and transforming it into an organized crime group that was engaged in almost every type of crime that you can imagine, including large-scale narcotic dealing like cocaine, methamphetamines, weapons dealing. There was obviously at some point violence and murder involved in protecting these assets, gold dealing, illegal timber, everything you can think of, he got into.
Piracy. They were trying to do piracy.
he wanted to do it all.
Yeah, it's truly an incredible story. But the reason that I was attracted to it ultimately was because at the time that I got involved in cryptocurrency, there was this suggestion that, well, no one knows who Satoshi Nakamoto is. We still don't know who it is. There's largely the belief that it's Hal Finney at this point, but really nobody knows. And one of the candidates essentially is Paul LaRue. So can you describe why he's a candidate for Satoshi Nakamoto?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely depends on who you ask. So I should say first, like when I was reporting the books, I reported the book over 5 years. At some point along the way, I began to believe that he was Satoshi. And I never found anybody who said anything about it. So I spent a lot of time during the book trying to figure it out. Couldn't come up with anything. So in the book, I say, I looked into it. I spent many, many hours on it. I don't think it's him. Some of the pieces of evidence kind of surfaced online and people started taking them in their own directions. And in some cases, they really latched onto them in ways that I had not latched onto them. The biggest one of which was that I got a hold of this fake passport that he had obtained. And the fake passport had the name Solochi on it. And it's very similar to Satoshi. That hooked a lot of people initially. You know,
like that's not the most compelling part to me personally, like, and maybe you disagree with me here, but like the most compelling part to me is the true crypt part and the libertarian kind of racism and the way he felt slighted. He wasn't given anything. And I could imagine that making somebody very, very mad.
I agree with you. What you're describing is probably the most compelling kind of set of evidence in his favor. But the passport, because the name is so close to Satoshi, that's the closest thing to like evidence. And there's sort of a difference here between evidence that matches up, like he could be the guy, and evidence that shows that he is the guy, or it might not even be a guy. Like, I mean, that's the funny thing. No one ever says that, but that's also like, no one knows who it is. The passport, that kind of like got me back into it because I had originally thought, but I know he got the passport at a certain point, and I talked to the guy who got it for him. It was like a fake passport that he paid a bunch of money for. And so when I talked to the guy, I was like, where did this name come from? Did he tell you to put Solochi on it? And the guy was like, no, he didn't tell me to put Solochi on it. They picked that when I got the fake passport. But then I realized the timing works such that it could be that he got the passport. And then a couple weeks later, that's when Satoshi first appeared. And so he's got this passport. It's got this name Solochi on it. Maybe he's just like, I'm trying to make up a name for my new anonymous character. I'm going to use Satoshi. And then he just threw a Japanese name on it. And that's thrown people off this whole time. Anyway, that is kind of like the thing that drew me back into it. I think, as you say, the most compelling parallel similarity that's coincidental and seems like evidence is that he created this encryption software called E4M. He did it entirely on his own, in secret, didn't tell anyone about it for the most part. And he just emerged and said, like, I have E4M. I've developed it. And he was really a forum guy. He was on forums. He was doing support. And there's a lot of parallels between how he did that and how Satoshi launched Bitcoin, including sending these emails that are very similar to previous people who had worked in the field and saying, hey, I'm going to use a little bit of your engine or a little bit of your work. I'm going to credit you for it. How should I properly credit you? Which was very similar to what Satoshi sent. Like, that is a very clear parallel. This is someone who could have done this. And then there's all these other things, the libertarianism, his writings. There's the like Commonwealth English, how you spell words. And you could start to accrue enough of them that it's absolutely believable that it's him.
One thing you mentioned there is that when you talk to like his cousin and some of these other people close to him, they had never heard of Bitcoin or heard him mention anything like that. Had they heard him mention encryption for masses or any of his other projects like that? Or did he also keep those secret from people close to him?
He didn't keep them secret. Everybody knew Paul was behind E4M. Like, he announced it. It was a secret when he was working on it, but I'm not sure he kept it like truly secret. It was more like he wasn't collaborating with anyone. The people I was talking to, many of them, they were like not even familiar with his technical work. To them, he was, in this case, like my cousin, but also like he runs a giant drug cartel. Like, that's what they knew about him. He's a genius. He runs a giant drug cartel. And I went back to still other people who I thought might know. A couple of them said things like, yeah, he talked about digital currency one time. And then someone else said, yeah, he said, if I really want to be independent or something of this nature, like I have to develop my own currency, like North Korea. But then you're interviewing them in hindsight, you know, they kind of know what I want to hear. I didn't take that as like strong evidence.
Can we actually delve into a bit of why he went from essentially developing encryption software to being a drug kingpin and how that transition occurred? Why that transition?
Yeah, I mean, both the how and the why, I have to say, like, there's still like a little bit of a mystery there. You know, we can speculate different ways. And of course, I've interviewed a lot of people who have different views on why he got into things. But essentially, he created E4M. And then there was a company that wanted to commercialize it. And he basically signed on with this company to try to commercialize it. They got into a dispute. He believed, I think, that he got screwed, that he never made anything for it. He kind of soured on open source software in some of the forums and said, like, look, I thought this was supposed to like somehow benefit me and it never did. And I've spent all these hours on it. And then TrueCrypt emerged. And so that was not clear if that was a challenger to what they were doing. Maybe he was behind it. It's sort of a big mess. But then the thing that was clear was he wanted to make a lot of money and he had not done so. And he felt like, I think at that time, programmers were starting to make a lot of money in the tech industry. He was not making a lot of money. And he got into online pills. There's a couple different theories about how he did. He was interested in online gambling as well. And he sort of came up with this system with a couple of other people involved that was perfect for mass distribution of painkillers. This was going to be the way he was going to like make his fortune. And I think he knew pretty quickly that he was going to succeed at that. Like, the signs were there from the very beginning that this was like an extremely lucrative thing to be doing.
Can you talk a little bit about what the RX Limited system looked like? Because it's fascinating to me, like, how it was at the beginning almost legitimate and like how he got all these doctors and pharmacists to sign on. So can you talk a little bit about what that looked like and how it functioned?
Yeah, I mean, it was a real gray area at the time, even throughout a lot of it. It was a gray area of the law. So essentially what he did was he recruited American doctors and American pharmacists into a network. He built all the technical infrastructure. He created websites that would market these drugs. I mean, at one point, he was responsible for a huge percentage of spam on the internet. He was responsible for over half of prescription drug sites on the internet were actually Paul LaRue. He was setting up thousands and thousands of them. But what happened was they would, you know, recruit a doctor and a pharmacist. And when someone bought from the website, their order would go to a doctor in the US who had signed onto the system. They would go to the system, look up this order, and write them a prescription. And then the prescription would be transferred to an American pharmacy where the pharmacist would say, oh, legitimate prescription. Okay. The pharmacist would use a FedEx number provided by RX Limited to then ship the drugs directly to your home. So you order from a website, they show up at your door a few days later, and the people in between had varying degrees of culpability in the legality or illegality of it. And in fact, several of the doctors who took it to trial were not convicted. They were found innocent because these were not scheduled drugs. This was not OxyContin. These were lesser known painkillers like tramadol, which is highly addictive, has the same many of the same properties, but they hadn't scheduled it yet. So that's what made the gray area. And really what made it illegal was the volume that they were doing it. I mean, you got doctors who are writing 1,000 prescriptions a day, you know, like that can't be right. Everyone knows that that can't be right, but it wasn't like strictly speaking illegal.
Yeah, in that sense, it was quite brilliant of him. And it does have like such a Joker energy to me or something. Like he felt slighted by this community. He decides like, I'm going to make my money and get back at all these people who ignored me and I'm going to prove them wrong. Then he like succeeds. It's very, very interesting and so reminiscent of so much that we see in cryptocurrency continually, like still to this day. Most of the people who were big names in the community have similar traits to this dude.
Yeah. And also people in the above board tech community, you know, he always seems so similar to me, to Zuckerberg, to Musk. I mean, and his story parallels Elon Musk's story, like quite closely, like he's South African, you know, and was a kid who got really into programming and like that was his way in the world. And he's really kind of like doing the same stuff on the other side of the law that a lot of these folks are doing, you know, lawfully. You may not think it's good for society. That's a different question. But people would ask me these questions like, why did he keep going? He made hundreds of millions of dollars. Why is he getting into like meth trafficking from North Korea? Why is he setting up a compound in Somalia? And the question is like, why is Mark Zuckerberg still going into Facebook every day? Like, what does he want? He has more money than he could ever spend. He's built a thing. Why is he still doing it? And the answer is kind of the same. Like, it's the same for both of them. Paul LaRue wanted to be the biggest criminal on the planet. That's what he wanted. And he set about trying to achieve that. And I would argue you possibly did.
What you mentioned there is like striking to me now because we've seen this like modern explosion in telemedicine. And like with some of these places even operating in controlled substances, I'm thinking of like Clear or Done, the companies that are specializing in like providing Schedule II medications for like ADHD and stuff after brief video consultations. Paul LaRue ended up doing a number of vastly criminal things, but like, as we mentioned, the idea itself and even the initial implementation wasn't like clearly very illegal. And even in your book, you profile how some of the doctors actually would take the time to try to review each questionnaire and would even occasionally reject some of the questionnaires. Now, other doctors used the accept all button and did not do that. But there was kind of some people who actually saw this as like a legitimate and different model for medicine that Paul LaRue was enabling. And so I think that kind of tension that you're getting at there, like how Paul has the personality traits of many of these people who we consider like legitimate successes, but ended up completely on the illegitimate side.
Yeah. And that ties into the Satoshi stuff too. Again, like I'm not saying he is Satoshi, but I think it's not just like, oh, this guy's a programmer who has the possibility to be him. And he also did some bad things and he was a drug dealer. He was in his way like a visionary. The telemedicine future, he absolutely saw that. Not only did he see it, he just built it entirely on his own. And when, you know, for instance, he would try to register domains, you know, and he was registering just like hundreds of domains. And then he just thought, well, if they penetrate that domain server, like they're going to know who I am. So then he just set up his own domain server. And like no one could get to him. It was all in the service of this system that, as you say, there are many systems that look like this now. They look extremely similar.
Yeah. And he creates his own domain registrar. He sets up his own email services. He starts having his entire workforce encrypt their computers using encryption software he built from scratch. He was much better at modeling the threats and understanding how to control, like, the technical infrastructure to protect himself than basically any other criminal of this status I've seen. And, like, taking those steps to try to insulate yourself and make it that much harder clearly benefited him. And in your telling of, like, the DEA agents who were investigating this, they kept feeling like they were getting closer. And then Paul would shift to an email service he controlled, would start encrypting things, would close off areas of communication they were following.
They never broke his encryption. They never got it to a server. They had to, like, put a computer in front of him and let him log into it. And I would say, arguably, they probably did not have the technical expertise to know what he did when he got in there. Like, he could have done any number of things. He had all kinds of self-destruct triggers set up. Like, who knows what he actually did when he logged in with them watching him and thinking that they're controlling him. He did give them access to some of the emails, so they did get evidence from there. But, like, a lot of it was never recovered.
It's worth noting that he essentially almost got away with all of this stuff. Maybe I'm getting this wrong, but Evan, you can correct me. But I believe there's no proper extradition treaty between Brazil and the United States of America, and or there was some sort of extradition treaty. And if you had a child in Brazil, you could avoid being extradited. And so he had a child in Brazil. I bring this up because you yourself tried to disappear. This was back in, I believe, 2009. You wrote an article for Wired called "Vanish for 1 month. Evan Ratliff shed his identity and tried to disappear. Here's what happened." And also "Gone Forever. What does it take to really disappear?" You didn't succeed. So I'm wondering if you could just kind of discuss why you didn't succeed and if you think maybe it's even harder now or if it's easier, like what your thoughts are about that these days.
You know, it was kind of meant to simulate someone who fakes their own death, because that's what I was very interested in at the time. It's like, you fake your own death and then what? I had trouble finding a story that would capture that. And so I decided to do this first person thing, and we set up all these parameters around it. And one of them was just that it's very easy to disappear if no one's looking for you. So the idea was, like, we would pay people, we would offer a reward for people to look for me. And that got a lot of people interested, including, like, professionals, private investigators, but also, like, groups of people who were organizing online. And it was eventually a group of non-professional investigators, like just people who organized originally on Twitter. Actually, Twitter was still pretty new then. It wasn't the cesspool that it is today. And they kind of, like, got together on Twitter. Then they moved to, like, increasingly private chats, and they organized to figure out how to catch me. Very quickly, the way they caught me was they captured my IP address on Facebook. So they basically set up a honey trap on Facebook, a website about me that was contained within Facebook, which you could do at the time. I visited that to see what they were up to. They found my IP address. So there were two challenges. One of them is, like, severing all ties with everything, just emotionally, your family, even for a short period of time. My thing was only a month, but, like, saying, I am not going to contact that life at all. And then the other one is, where are you going to get money? You have to go get a job. Can't use your social security number. You can't use your bank accounts. Cryptocurrency is sort of an answer to that. But, like, in the early days where it was like anonymous currency, I was like, well, this is it. This is how you would do it. You would just put a ton of money into crypto and then you would, like, get it out on the other end. But, like, we all know that is a fool's errand at this point, both just, like, literally getting it out at all, but also getting it out in a way that you're not going to have to provide some sort of identification in order to do so. Or you can go to the more private coins, and then it's like, am I going to lose all this money? Like, it's something that require a lot of expertise. Of course you could do it, but now there is a better option when it comes to money. On the other hand, I mean, the amount of surveillance, of course, has just expanded massively. There's so many entry points for investigators. There is so much data that can be sucked up about you. I think it's harder now than it was then, I would say.
Even though there's all these obvious, like, oh, this person tried, or this person tried and failed, this person tried and failed, or maybe this person died and disappeared and we don't even know. That's the issue. You could never possibly know all the successful stories that there are, even though it does feel like, to me at least, that it's very, very, very difficult. And on top of that, if anyone is looking for you in any real capacity, it becomes almost impossible to successfully disappear. Even people like Joe Lowe, who stole billions of dollars from Malaysia, but he just is existing in China now. There's no mystery about it. That's where he is. He's doing fine. There's ways to disappear without actually disappearing now, maybe, is what I'm saying. Similar to like what Paul LaRue did, where it's like, yeah, I'm in Brazil, but good luck getting to me. Maybe that's like the easier way to do it now. Maybe that's the actual way to disappear, in air quotes.
Yeah, if you have enough money, there's a lot that you can do. You know, if you're just a vastly wealthy individual, however you've gotten that money, you got a lot of options. Also, you can set up a lot of things in advance. I mean, we've seen recently people buying citizenship in various countries. That's a very, if you've got enough money to pay, drop $1 million on real estate in Portugal or whatever it is, or Malta, you know, you can do that. But for ordinary people, you're really up against it because you've got to have planned out how you're going to survive in this new identity. I mean, the problem with most of these fake death stories is that people don't plan it out. Like, they do it on an impulse. They're like running a Ponzi scheme, and then the Ponzi scheme's about to collapse. And then they say, oh my God, I'm going to fake my death. I'll drive my car to the river. And then they'll think I jumped in the river. And then like 3 days later, they're like, oh, I don't have any money. I can't use my credit cards. You know, like, it's not all planned out. And they don't have billions of dollars hiding somewhere where they can kind of access it. So, I mean, I was trying to more represent that type of person. I didn't have the resources to like make things happen for myself.
Cass, there was kind of a point you made there that Paul LaRue recognized regulatory arbitrage and like the existence of these varied extradition treaties as like a way to run these types of businesses well before, like, cryptocurrency companies have learned a little bit from that. And like, you'll often see the executives for some of the less than sterling ones try to set up in places where they think it'll be difficult to extradite them, and will like make sure their corporate registrations are in places that aren't tied to places like the United States that actually enforce laws, and will try to like take advantage of things like that. And so we saw Paul LaRue operating out of the Philippines and Somalia. And we see that now with cryptocurrency companies operating out of Malta and, well, previously China, out of all this. And so there's certainly kind of an echo. Paul LaRue recognized the ability of that, and cryptocurrency companies have learned since then.
I mean, what Paul LaRue did in the Philippines was he paid millions of dollars in bribes to law enforcement. I mean, literally straight to the judges, police, generals, had an ex like NBI, which is the FBI there, guy basically on his staff that carried bags of money to people in order to bribe them. And that's the extreme version. The less extreme version is sort of setting up your operation in a place where the legal system is never going to be able to handle some kind of like cryptocurrency dispute. They're not equipped for that. And you know that. And so, you know, unlike in the US, like, you're operating like in a little more of a protected environment.
Your most recent work, Persona, this podcast about Gilbert Chicle, there's so many ties to what we regularly cover here on Crypto Critics Corner that I would love if you could expand on that a bit, and then we're going to delve into the similarities.
So Gilbert Chicle is a con man. He was born in France, but he moved to Israel, took Israeli citizenship. The thing he's originally famous for is inventing something called the President Scam, or at least pioneering something called the President Scam, which is basically where you call up a mid-level person at a company and you say, I'm the boss of this company, like I'm the CEO or the president, so it's called the President Scam. And there's going to be a secret project that you're going to get contacted for. We have a secret project going on. Usually it's like to stop money laundering or stop terrorists from using our bank or our company. You're going to hear from a secret agent. And the secret agent, who originally was also Gilbert, he would say, we need to take money out of the bank and mark the bills so that when the terrorists come and take their money out of the bank, we'll know it's them. We'll give them that money. So he would, over many days, convince someone that they were part of this project, that they couldn't tell anyone. They couldn't tell their family. They couldn't tell their colleagues. In his most famous case, his original success, he got this woman to bring hundreds of thousands of euros to a bathroom in a cafe in Paris and hand it to someone who knocked on the door and said a code word. And then he got into like having them transfer it rather than bring the cash. But that was the fundamental model, was like, first, it's a high up person in the company who the mid-level person probably doesn't really know, but imbues with a lot of authority. You do what they say. Then the secret agent. And this became a model for scams. It's used all over the world. I mean, the variation on it is like the email, business email compromise is kind of a variation on it. And it's worth billions of dollars. So he did that. And then he ran a different scam 10 years later on a bunch of very, very wealthy French-speaking people.
These are affinity scams, right? I mean, these are essentially what he's doing is he's saying, I am an important person within this specific group of let's say a corporation, and you have to trust me. I'm your boss. I need you to work on this mission, which is just unreal. You think to yourself, like, how could anyone fall for this? But then you hear the story that you're telling in this podcast, and it's like, well, I mean, I guess I understand why someone would fall for it. I like, why would you have any reason to doubt that the president of the company is going to call you and be like, hey, there's a money laundering issue. We need somebody in the middle of the company to help take care of it. Don't tell anybody. It's very affinity, but also very like nuanced in a sense. But it devolves very quickly. The story starts getting into poker and the Israel and France and all of this craziness. My ears instantly were like, whoa, I have heard this story so many times before. Bennett and I covered a company called Crypto Capital Corp, and I ended up figuring out where these people who ran it, these were fugitives from U.S. prosecution. They'd fled from anywhere where people knew, and I discovered one of them leaving Google reviews in Israel, and she, you know, just openly like, oh, I love this restaurant, I love this hotel, and I was like, hey, you're on the hook for $800 million. Like, you're just chilling in Israel? And it was like, yes, yes, she is, and Israel doesn't care. Like, they're not sending her back to America to face justice. Like, no, that isn't what's going to happen. I assume her brother is there as well. And it's just like, oh, okay. Israel doesn't give a shit, which is kind of like, I don't know. I don't even know how to feel about it. It's wild to me that such a tight ally is just like, yeah, you know, fraud, scams, whatever.
Well, and that's where Paul LaRue ran a bunch of his call centers, too.
Yeah.
Paul had a lot of stuff based in Israel. And a bunch of the Israelis were never extradited for crimes. I mean, there's a couple that are under indictment in the U.S., one of whom escaped from a halfway house and went to Israel and has never been brought back, one of LaRue's people. But when I interviewed a lot of Israeli police officials, ex-police officials, and they would always say, everybody says we don't extradite people. We extradited this person, this person, this person, this person. Like, they do extradite people. I think with these frauds and these scams, the tricky thing is, of course, that like the victims are not in Israel. And so there's not like a constituency for like really agitating for it, except for this like intergovernmental relationship. In Shikley's case, they did extradite him. They extradited him to France. The French fucked it up. They let him out and he just flew back to Israel. And then the Israelis were like, no, we're not going to do this again. Actually, the French never even asked because they were too embarrassed. But like, the Israelis were like, you had
to
shot.
Take away his passport. They just forgot to take away his passport.
Classic mistake. You spend years getting a guy investigated, finally extradited. It's an incredibly arduous process. He arrives in France. They don't try him for like 18 months. And then they're like, well, now we got to let him out on house arrest. They just made him sign in at a police station. And then he just left.
The people who I was looking into, Oz Yosef and Ravid Yosef, they walked away with hundreds of millions of dollars. Sorry, why exactly would Israel want to extradite these people? They have hundreds of millions of dollars to spend in Israel. Like, they can't go anywhere else, really. They have all this money there. I don't see what the reason would be that Israel would be like, all right, get on back to the U.S. now. It doesn't make any sense to me. But like you said, there's also this interstate, like, you would hope that Israel would be like, well, we know exactly where this person is and we're going to ship them back to you because we're friends. But I guess that's not enough.
It's just such a hard process. And like, they tend to focus on the murderers, and everyone would talk about between France and Israel, you know, it was all about these people who had killed someone. And those were like the big ones. And like someone who's committed a fraud, they're just like, they're not high on the list. You know,
to me, this concept of like, well, financial fraud doesn't really harm people. I'm like, how can anyone argue that anymore? Like, the amount of people that killed themselves because of Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme or Enron or like any of these major gigantic frauds. Like, we understand that there's actually like levels of violence involved in these deceptions. And I think it's pretty silly to be like, nah, it's just money. It's like, no. It's not just money.
Well, and I think Madame G was a good example of that.
The original victim of the one who gave the money in the bathroom of the cafe, like, it ruined her life. Like, she lost her job at the bank. She was a bank manager. She became suicidal. She became homeless, and she eventually got herself back on her feet. But yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think part of the reason why we like live in a scam world today is that no one really takes it seriously at a small scale or a large scale. Not just that it's just about money, but like, you're kind of responsible. Like, you fell for it. You know, I think that's the feeling. And part of what's interesting about trying to tell these stories is trying to get across the idea that like, this can happen to you no matter who you are. And some of the victims later from Shikley were some of the wealthiest, supposedly most savvy people in the world, billionaires, who lost tens of millions of dollars to someone who called them up on the phone and told them they needed money, in this case, to free hostages from ISIS. Like, that was the scam. If someone has your number, if someone has the right information, if someone can really kind of convince you to like get on board in the first step, you'd be surprised what you could fall for.
And it struck me like before when you were talking about how business compromise email scams are basically a version of this. A ton of the cryptocurrency exchange hacks we've seen are either publicly known as or privately whispered about as business email compromise scams. Like Bitstamp, in their security report that was leaked after they got hacked, it talked about how the hacker was able to get a bunch of information about one of the executives, started emailing with them from like a somewhat trusted location or something about phishing and about normal things like that, until they eventually convinced them to open a file that had a compromise that was able to get them into the system, because they had built up this rapport with this high-level executive who's been trained on phishing, who's been trained on like OPSEC and what to do, to end up doing the same compromise. The 2016 Bitfinex hack was probably broadly similar in terms of how it was executed. The tendency to victim blame ends up ramming straight into the fact that many of these victims are people who were trained and knowledgeable and taught to do this, and that just many of us are way more vulnerable to social engineering than we are inclined to admit.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I mean, the solution to it is only to tell people about it. It was like, you know, in Shikley's scam, if you knew about it, you were less likely to fall for it, but not entirely unlikely to fall for it. Like, people who knew about it still fell for it.
Victim blaming is a very real thing, but it's not just victim blaming in this scam, fraud, financial thing. It's also this concept, and I've discussed this with a lot of our guests. Let's educate people. Let's make sure people understand how these frauds and scams and all of this works. Like, when people are promising you crazy interest rates, don't just believe it. But so many people that we've had on here or on Twitter or anywhere suggest, like, the only way to learn is to experience the scam yourself. And until you experience the scam yourself, there really is no education for this kind of thing. I think your books and your work does a very good job of actually educating people about this stuff in some sense.
Yeah, I don't think there's a good answer. I think that's the best answer. The best answer is trying to tell people, when you go online, if something seems exceptionally good, you should cast doubt upon it. Like, that's the only thing you can really do. You know, run some due diligence yourself, see how you could check it out. But that's still a losing endeavor. I mean, you're talking about a world in which, like, anyone from any part of the world can now scam someone else. If someone's just really good at this, like Gilbert Shikley, they could just reach out and grab victims all over the world. Like, that didn't used to be true. It's probably not possible to educate people to the extent that, like, no one will fall for these things, particularly because a lot of them are based on romance scams. Like, what are you going to do? Make people not feel lonely, not pursue relationships online? You know, like, you can't make everyone be suspicious about everything all the time. That's no way to live. So I think that's where we're trapped, is like, the scams are so profligate now, but also you can't really say, like, don't do anything online. Like, there are people who do that, of course. They're like, I don't do anything online. But that's not realistic either.
Like you mentioned there, like, because things have become so global, because it's so international now and we're all so connected, that, as we've kind of alluded to, makes it really hard to even pursue the people who commit these things. In both the Paul LaRue case with the DEA and in the Gilbert case with the French investigators, they understood, like, the scam. They understood what was going on. They understood the crimes and even the criminal. But because of, like, the challenges of actually pursuing international, like, law enforcement cases, it took so long for them, from when they had, like, identified what was going on until they were actually able to bring indictments, get people arrested, and do any of that. The other side, besides the education, is potentially going after the people who do it. But going after the people who do it is just such a challenging task when it's such a low barrier of entry for someone to start doing this. And it's so hard for law enforcement, for regulators, for whoever, to actually go after and seize these people. And so it's just a really challenging problem.
Yeah. I mean, that's what happened with LaRue. I mean, LaRue was one of the most targeted people by the DEA. But even that, you know, when you see one case, you say, oh, they went and got him. They set up a big sting operation. They lured him out of Brazil where he was hiding and he'd had this child to try to avoid extradition. They lured him to Liberia and they had him arrested. But, like, how many people are you going to do that for? Like, it's a huge operation. It required an informant. It was dangerous for that informant. He could have been killed. The Americans are the only ones who can do this. No one else really has the capacity to do it. A couple other countries do it a little bit. But do you want the U.S. to just be like a global police force that's running sting operations in countries all over the world? I mean, they are when it comes to drugs. Is that what we want? Is that what we are paying for? Like, that's a big question that no one really asks. You know, we want the people caught, but then if you look at what it would take to catch all the people that they definitely know where they are and what they're doing, it would be enormous outlay of resources.
There's somebody named Do Kwon. I'm sure you're familiar.
From your show.
There you go. So the creator of Luna and Terra, we've discussed him at length, but he had an Interpol red notice put out for him. He is wanted by the South Korean government. No one wants anything more than to get their hands on him to bring him to justice. And yet he's gone. No one can tell you where he is exactly. He's not in Singapore. He's not in South Korea, and he's not in the US. That's what we do know. But he could be literally anywhere else in the entire world. And there's nothing anyone can do about it. And it's exactly what you're talking about. Like, the only way to get this guy would be to do a giant sting operation. And I'm sure, especially right now, this guy is on his toes. Like, he's not going to fall for anything. I just don't know how you could ever possibly do that for these 100,000, 150,000 more criminals who are doing financial fraud and all this other stuff. Like, it's incredible numbers, and there's no way you could actually do it.
I haven't written about any crypto scams. Like, I haven't reported on any. Like, I've learned some from watching you guys' show or listening to you guys' show, which I like. Crypto is such a scam-rich environment, and they're so kind of like straightforward. If you look at them, a lot of them, they're just like, I have a thing, and I'm going to tell you it's going to be worth more and more money, so you should buy it now. And then, like, now I'm gone. They're very like simple Ponzi schemes or the hack and steal kind of ones. There's so many of them that I don't know how law enforcement could possibly get a handle on them at this point. Like, how could you triage the number of scams that have taken place?
But also a thing that I really loved from Persona was that you specifically said that this scam brought out the art in con artist. Even though it was so simple, it was like sophisticated and beautiful in a sense. It's made me start rethinking all of these scam artists in crypto, where I'm like, I don't respect them, but I do respect their work.
Con artists, they're really like storytellers. Like, they tell you a story that includes you. So in Shikley's case, it like, it makes you feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself. And that's very, very hard to resist. We're all living our lives, and then someone drops into our life and they tell us you're important. Sometimes there's not even greed involved. Like, the people don't stand to make any money. And Shikley's, they didn't. It was just like, we'll know that you helped our nation stop these terrorists. And that was all it took. In a sense, it's like an incredibly creative endeavor.
The other thing I noticed as I discussed with Bennett that I only recently started realizing seems to run pretty like fluidly through all of these incredible stories of fraudsters in finance is how they all play poker. Like, poker is such a running theme in this. And I was like, what is that? Bennett was like, to get good at poker, you have to be a good liar. And I'm like, oh yeah.
Poker comes up in Persona. And I did like spend some time trying to answer this question. In fact, I talked to a journalist friend of mine, Keith Romer, who like reports on poker a lot. And he also plays poker. This was the question that I wanted to answer. I was like, all these guys play poker. So what is the reason? And eventually we kind of talked it out. And there's sort of two sides to it. One is playing high stakes poker in private rooms is like a pretty good way to launder money. You could move your money through poker. But I think the bigger part of it is just personality based. It's just psychology based. The kind of person who is pulling off scams, those are very, very high stakes endeavors. And they are drawn to the adrenaline of almost losing every time, you know, almost getting caught. I mean, in this story, there were scammers who were not actually good at poker. Mostly they wanted to play in the highest stakes games. And they lost, like they lost a bunch of money. But I think it was the feeling of it, of the adrenaline, you know?
What you said there, like, was striking to me because I was remembering from Persona when Gilbert called back up someone he had just scammed and said, Google my name plus scam and see what comes up. At a certain point, he was like, this is too easy. I shouldn't be getting away with this anymore. And like, wanted to make it so it was harder for himself, wanted to make it so there was like a chance he could get caught. That echoes that this is like a form of thrill seeking, that this is about the adrenaline, the rush from it, rather than like actually getting the reward, the money, the power, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I found interesting was your take on how much trust is involved in poker, which is not something I generally think about either. They'll hand over $100,000 to another player just on a whim, right? It's just like, here you go, man. I'm going to, yeah, you need $100,000 to buy back in right now? Sure, no problem. And I was like, that is like catnip for financial scammers. In a sense, even though I love it, it's like a cesspool.
Well, there's one part I would disagree with there, which I think you have to distinguish a little bit between sort of mainstream high stakes poker. Like, there's a whole circuit and community of those people, except some of them are genius level poker players.
They are, but they almost all have also been involved in things like poker's Black Friday, all this like shady online poker dealings that they absolutely were a part of. And it's been put to bed now, and we just move on with our lives. And I think there's a lot of that.
Yeah. And I mean, my question, my kind of hilarious in hindsight question, it was sort of like, why are they letting these scammers into these like high stakes poker? Like, these guys are losers. Like, why are they letting them into these games in Vegas? And the answer was because they're losers. Like, that's they're losers. Like, they bring a bunch of money and lose it to us. Like, they will be welcome anytime. So there's sort of like, they're the rubes there, you know? So their reputation does, who cares if it's tarnished? They cheat, they do whatever. People let them back in because they just bring a bunch of money. But like the real players, it's more like self-regulated community where people don't want to be known as cheats.
Didn't Paul try to launch some online gambling sites?
He looked into it, and there's differing stories about it. There's one guy who had a whole elaborate story that he had gone to Costa Rica and met with this lawyer to set up this gambling site. And like, actually, this ties back into the Satoshi stuff, both because like I kept looking for some kind of Liberty Reserve connection that would really tie Paul to eGold. And then it would make sense that he got into it. And I never really found it. But there was this other kind of coincidence where part of the original Bitcoin software, which got commented out of the software, of the code, there was a little poker playing engine built in there. And Paul supposedly also built an engine. And it's like, okay, well, yeah, sure. A lot of people could build a poker engine. But it was another one of those, like, they start piling up and you're like, how many of these things are we going to have before we say, it's probably him?
How many expert C++ programmers are there who are also knowledgeable enough in cryptography to design the whole key pair system and able to create a poker engine just in the code, because you think it might someday be useful? That's a much smaller set.
That's where it all fell down, though, was your question. How many are there? If we said, okay, the universe of these people is 10, I'd put all my money on Paul. Universe of those people is 100. It's different. If it's 1,000, if it's 10,000, you're like, what are we doing here? Like, yeah, okay, maybe it's him. There's a lot of coincidences, but it's probably not him. What I always wanted and still want is evidence. Like, I don't know if anyone would believe it at this point, but there is something out there that will tie someone more specifically to it. If it is Paul, I think that thing exists. I haven't been able to find it. And now people are bringing me all kinds of like faked examples of it. So I'm not even sure I could find it at this point.
What faked examples are people bringing?
As you can imagine, because I wrote about Paul and Satoshi, like I get a lot of people who are like, no, this guy's Satoshi. Here's all my evidence, whether it's one of the original candidates like Hal Finney or it's someone new they think it is. I'm also contacted by people who say like, I know it's Paul. And one source in particular provided me with signed messages from one of the early blocks. So first 100 blocks, signed messages that implicate Paul in being Satoshi very directly. And the messages are real. Like, they're signed messages. You can go check, like, I checked them out. They're real. Like, that part of it is very, very difficult to fake, like a faked signed message. So for a while I was like, wow, this is it. But the problem is those blocks, no one knows who controls them. It's very, very difficult to backdate the signed messages to figure out exactly when they're sent. So obviously if someone owns this block and they sent the signed message like 2 weeks ago, Paul Larue Satoshi, and then they contacted me and were like, look at this signed message. The message would check out, but it's not dated. So it's difficult to say like when it was sent. So then when I consulted with people who were more expert than myself, they were like, well, who controls these? Who controls the keys to these anymore? Like, we know who controlled them at the beginning. If they sent the message at that time, absolutely 100% proof, it's him. But the keys could have been transferred. Keys were stolen, keys were lost. We have no idea who controls those. There are also now people out there who want it to be Paul for their various reasons. And so I thought I had it there for like a day. And now I'm pretty convinced that they're fake.
But it was from a known Satoshi address, or was it just from an early block? Because like we know the first 9 blocks were all Satoshi, but after that, like with the first transaction to Hal Finney in block 9, we start seeing other people come online. And so was it just someone with an early block, or was it from like the list of known Satoshi addresses?
It wasn't from one of the Satoshi addresses. If it was from the Satoshi addresses, that would have been, I feel like, also definitive, but it wasn't from one of the Satoshi addresses. I was like, oh, we can figure out when a signed message was sent, but you can't.
But if you knew who the person was who supposedly controlled that address, they could sign another message proving they still control the keys.
If that person was alive, yes.
Ah, yes. Yes, that can complicate things.
If the person is not alive, we're in a bind. That's where I found
that
myself.
That does make that makes it much harder for them to prove they control the keys.
But I mean, my overall point is that there's like so much stuff swirling around this. There's like at least 5 or more documentaries that have contacted me that are specifically like Who is Satoshi documentaries. It makes me feel like, I don't know if we'll ever know.
There are people forging evidence. Craig Wright is actively forging evidence, including doing fake block signings using modified software.
You said it, not me.
The courts said it. God, the courts said they were forgeries. To be clear, that is not a libelous statement. It is in the public record that his evidence he submitted were forgeries. That's in the court's record. That is not libel.
Did you think it was interesting, Evan, that Paul, when he was up for parole, said he was going to start a Bitcoin business?
That was at his sentencing. So the question at his sentencing was, when you return to society, how will you be a productive member of society? And he said, I'm going to start a Bitcoin business. And there's a lot of different ways to read that. I mean, one way is like, he's Satoshi and he's going to start a Bitcoin business. That's like a cover for him just finally like recovering all of the billions of dollars that he has access to. But it seems strange. Like, that's a strange thing to assert if you are in fact Satoshi. Part of it could be like, by that point, he heard people had said he was Satoshi and he's just messing with them. Like, he's going to be in prison for 20 years. So maybe he's just fucking around. And part of it is maybe he's like, I'll capitalize on the fact that people think that I'm Satoshi. So I will start a Bitcoin business and like, I'll get tons of clout and attention and money for it because people think that I'm actually Satoshi. A final theory is like, when he got out of prison, that's absolutely what Balaru would get into. So it makes sense that he would choose that. It was weird that he suggested that to a judge as, this is how I will be a productive member of society, because like a federal judge is not going to, they're just not going to hear that.
Perceive it that way.
Yeah. They're not going to hear that as like, I'm going to, you know, work at a bank. They would probably say like, that's exactly the kind of thing you shouldn't get into, sir.
I'm going to advance this anti-state currency via my business, which I intend to operate internationally. This shouldn't concern you at all.
But I wanted to ask you guys, like, do you guys think it matters who it is?
The important part is that there's mystery and that we don't know who it is and that those first coins never move. If that remains the case, I think it's great for Bitcoin. I think as soon as we know, if we ever were able to find out who it was and he or she or they were able to move those million Bitcoins, that might be the end of Bitcoin for good. Who knows? But it would be really bad news for Bitcoin.
I would love nothing more than the day after Paul finally gets released from prison, we see like Coinbase Bitcoins from the first 9 blocks start moving and like getting deposited onto some exchange or something, just because the pure chaos of that would be devastation across the industry. And I think Cass is right. The best case scenario for Bitcoin is for there to be at least some ambiguity, because it allows Satoshi to act as this kind of messianic figure in the Bitcoin religion, where they created this thing and that it was this almost immaculate conception. And if you like look at the blocks, you can see like Satoshi was very carefully like keeping their hash rate at a certain level and trying to make sure other people could competitively mine and start doing it in things like this. Having that, and then having this mysterious figure who disappeared right as it was starting to get like the tiniest bit of traction, lets Bitcoin exist in a more substantially decentralized way than it can with like a central figure who controls 5% of the total supply. And the other flip side is for Coinbase, when they're going in to talk to the CFTC and the SEC and Congress people, it's a lot easier for them to talk about Bitcoin if they don't need to explain that it was started by a racist, sexist leader of a drug cartel. Just saying it was this person no one knows lets you kind of remove that. Sure. And even if you should say Bitcoin should be separate from its creator, the reality is if Paul LaRue is behind Bitcoin, that is going to color people's perceptions of Bitcoin.
If it was to be Hal Finney instead, who has passed away, I do think it would be bad because now you have some of the mystery disintegrate and you know exactly who the first person was. It wouldn't be as bad as a Paul LaRue because Paul LaRue is still living. Paul LaRue can still move those coins. And Paul LaRue, like you said, has a lot of horrible elements behind who the man and the mystery is. It is good for Bitcoin to not have an answer to that for as long as possible. I also think that if you're Satoshi and you are brilliant and a mastermind, as your book talks about Paul LaRue, you would know better than to move those first coins.
Well, the funny thing is, like, if it is him, there's like an equal chance that, yeah, he could get out and move the coins, but also that he like wrote down the keys in some place that like his former henchmen like ransacked and were like, what is this? And just threw it in the trash, you know? Like, he hasn't moved him. If it is him, he hasn't moved him yet. And so maybe he's waiting to get out, or maybe he's like, he doesn't have the keys to it either.
That's certainly possible that like the keys are lost, that whoever Satoshi was, whether it was Paul, whether it was Hal, whether it was Adam, whoever it might've been, or whichever team of people it might've been. I think it's very plausible that the keys for those early blocks for the known Satoshi addresses are permanently lost, even if Satoshi is alive, just because key management is hard for people, especially when the keys are protecting something that is at the time valueless, right? Or has in some respects a negative value because having that proves you're the person who started this, right? And so I think it's quite plausible whoever did it might have even intentionally destroyed or not kept the keys, because having them would suggest to someone who came across them that you were responsible for creating this thing, which at the time, even Satoshi noted, like when the WikiLeaks started accepting Bitcoin, like there was a risk of some serious like public perception or backlash to Bitcoin when it started to catch on. So I think that, yeah, it's very plausible that no one has those keys.
The last question I have for you, Evan, is, you wrote The Mastermind a little while ago. You've done Persona, and you've also done the long form podcast for an extended period of time now. And I'm wondering if you look at the realm we're in now and you yourself perceive podcasting as a more viable option for you to tell these stories, or if you're instead thinking like, no, I will be writing Persona in a book form as well, or like what your thoughts are on the changing landscape of storytelling, perhaps.
For most of my career, I've been a freelancer. When you're independent, I feel like you just kind of develop this mercenary outlook. And my mercenary outlook is there's certain types of stories that I want to tell. And the form is important, but I'm open to like a variety of forms. And you'll see a lot of journalists going from one to another now because there's more money in podcasting to do narrative than there was previously. And that's the kind of stories that I'm interested in, like these long, intricate stories that start from point A and end up at point B. Podcasting is a way to do it, but like books are still viable for individuals like me. It's a great situation. I should take that back. It's not a great situation, but it's like a better situation when there are these new venues that are interested in this type of story. So now podcast makers are very interested in this type of story. For like the media as a whole, there's a larger question of like, is this a bubble? Is this viable? Like over the long term, like where will podcasting end up? And there's so many podcasts, everybody has a podcast, all that kind of stuff. Those questions are less important to me as a creator in that I just kind of like look where the money is and where the possibility is and the journalists that I respect and the editors that I want to work with. And I kind of like sign on with them to do something. And then if that thing goes away, I will now go over here and do it with these people. And so there's benefits and drawbacks to that as well. Like I have no institutional security or backing in a general sense. I think it is like incredible, the idea of telling these journalistic stories over multiple episodes in a narrative way. And now you see lots of examples of stories that might have been books or magazine stories ending up there. And I think that's been very good for the people who created them. I hope that continues. If that doesn't continue, all the people like me will like find some other medium to do it.
That's a very pragmatic answer to which medium you choose to tell your stories. Evan, do you have any parting thoughts for our audience? And can you let them know where to find you?
We haven't really gotten into this aspect of it, but the through line for all these stories for me is partly about the people they have pulled into them, pulled into participating in criminal activities. Not even necessarily the people at the top, but all the people along the way. And the way that when you look at them from a distance, you say, oh, look at those terrible people. Look at those bad, evil people doing that evil thing. The closer you get to it, the more complicated it gets. And the more you understand.
The more human it gets.
The more human it gets. The more you understand the motivations. The more you understand the mistake that someone can make in one moment that then defines the rest of their life. And I feel like that's the thing I'm always chasing in these stories, is trying to understand how these people kind of like fell into this world and how it relates to the choices that we also make or don't make around our own lives. So that's to me like the part that's interesting about these criminal networks in particular, is they involve a bunch of people who are like operating at the fringes of this and never thought that they would get involved in it. And the question is like, why did they get involved in it? It's called Persona, the French Deception. The Mastermind is available in paperback. I'm on Twitter if you want to look me up. I try to stay off there as much as possible, but you can still find me there. It's ev_rat.
It is a cesspool. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.